Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
Sorry, I was late. I was working on a toilet.
That was always Clark Kent's excuse, you know, when Superman, you know, was out doing something. So
you're getting a little too close to home now. I had to correct my text. I said I have a bathroom emergency, and I thought, I don't want to send that. I don't want to send that message. That's the wrong message. It could be, but it's the wrong message.
Right, it's a very different idea, isn't it?
So what was the quote that you sent, Patrick?
I'm just going to read it verbatim. So this is from D. Hawk, 1929 to 2022, who wrote, "Life is not about control. It is not about getting. It is not about having or knowing. It is not even about being. Life is eternal, perpetual, becoming, or it is nothing. Becoming is not a thing to be known, commanded, or controlled. It is a magnificent, mysterious odyssey to be experienced." Near the end of 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety, it captures the same becoming, the journey, versus the outcome, controlling. Emotional stability is achieved in our lives by becoming aware of our toxic beliefs and unenforceable rules, the ideas that make our emotional balance dependent on external conditions. Once we become aware of these unenforceable rules, we must surrender them. We need to move towards an attitude of, I'm okay even if this or that happens, and away from the idea that I'm okay only if this happens or that happens. This is emotional freedom. This freedom brings more stability to our canoe. We might even dance in it if we wish.
You know, one of the things I think people appreciate is what we need is a bad example. And every example is a good example. And I say that lovingly and, you know, self-effacing, but not self-condemning. I struggle with this every day. Like, I want to know what I can do to control my environment, you know, to ensure that if I do these steps, this is how it'll be, and it'll stay that way. And life is never that. You never get to spike the football, roll the credits, not while you're alive anyway. And so I don't want to die, and I resist change. So what am I going to do? The best I can do is to be more self-aware when I start ruminating, when I start wanting to control, when I start thinking I need things to be stable, like environmentally stable, for me to be at peace inside, as opposed to being calm in a snowstorm or, you know, on a shaky boat or dancing in my canoe, right? Standing up and doing the jig, right? What's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to get wet. I want to be more able to just go with the flow. And that, I think, for me, and I'm sure for somebody else listening, is the rub. Self-knowledge isn't a cure for me. I still have to practice this starting from my first waking thoughts, which are always this things to do list, as opposed to, what a beautiful day. I'm going to be curious and bring positive regard. That's not how my brain starts the day. Don't know about you guys.
Human beings fear uncertainty more than anything else. We hate change. And the only thing certain about life is change. And so, therefore, we are the only species that we know of who lives in fear of reality. Wisdom inside of us is like wisdom among us. It's like wise people do not come up to you and slap you around and give you unsolicited wisdom. They don't. I mean, these negative people who are controlling, often when people say something to me out of that space, I just want to go like, did I even ask you a question? You know, it's like, we don't ask for it, we get it. But the cool thing about the wisdom is it's right there when we want it. And the thing I've learned to put into my practice now, Joe, that's exactly connected to what you're saying is, the first thing is I only control one thing, and that's my mind. You know, nothing else. I can control how I interpret the world. I can interpret how I choose to respond to the world, and that's all. And that's, I've discovered for right now anyway, that's the most important reminder for me to have to start every day.
flowing with becoming, right? And having faith in that. See, that's such a challenging thing because of our anxiety, right? My anxiety makes me, turns me into a control freak. And now I think I've got to somehow wrestle security from life rather than, you know, be secure in my ability.
That's a great phrase. Wrestle security from life. It's just such an image. I love that, Alan.
I've always been counted out when I try that. I'm always getting pinned for some reason.
I love it.
I've never won that match. I'm like 100-0 or something. You know, it's like. But, you know, I never fail to just keep trying that. I mean, it's like that it is a compulsion. There's no question about it. And, you know, it starts very early on in life. I mean, just think about, I mean, I've got kids, right? And how much I wanted to control them and get them to do, quote, what I wanted them to do, which in my mind was the right thing most oftentimes, right? But my buddy, Jesper Juul, wrote an incredible book. Yeah, Jesper passed now, and may he rest in peace. But his book was Your Competent Child. What a great title. Book, right? And you know what his thesis in the whole book was? Let go. There is something in your child that's going to grow your child into who that child needs to be. If you nurture that, nourish that, and encourage it rather than try to control them and make them into that, that force is so powerful in them. And he said, you know, for example, the desire to cooperate and please is so hardwired in us. You don't have to force your child to do that. Your child's going to want to cooperate and please. And a lot of times what's experienced is not cooperation means that a parent isn't able to see that in the child's behavior, they are cooperating. It's like I was working with this one family this one time, and they couldn't believe how difficult their child was being all the time. No matter what they asked their child to do, they were labeling their child as oppositional, right? Because they were always arguing, always coming up with. And then I watched the parents behave. And you know what they did? Same thing. And this is what Kempler noted, which I thought was brilliant, Joe. He said, when kids are cooperating with their parents and doing what their parents taught them to do, and then are being criticized for it, it throws them into a quandary.
And confusing as hell. Yeah.
That's when kids get disturbed. Is when they are cooperating, they're doing exactly what their parents taught them to do, but now their parents are criticizing them for it. Interesting observation, huh?
It is. I got Tom hooked on that Gabor Maté book, The Myth of Normal, and he talks about how kids need attachment, but they also need authenticity. Right. So not only and people coming into recovery need that too. A community that will accept them exactly the way they are without making them conform. Because if we can't be authentic, you know, if we have to hide our true selves, that we've lost connection to the community. And this approach to child rearing is exactly the same. Right. Don't outcast your child, you know, with needs for conformity or criticism. Do you know the song Perfect from the album Jagged Little Pill by Alanis Morissette is 30 years old today?
Yeah, all that 90s music's getting old. Yeah, but that's a beautiful song.
Try to make it your outro.
Yeah, we'll get slapped, but we shouldn't. I mean, I think Alanis would like us.
What? Tell me about the song. I'm not familiar with it.
It's about a child talking to their parent, feeding back to the parent all of the sort of toxic messaging that they've been giving their kids. And it's an anthem. It's a real anthem.
It's almost like it's written from the point of view of the impossible, demanding perfectionist voice. You know, it's like, so I'll just read the last little verse. It's be a good boy, push a little farther now. That wasn't fast enough to make us happy. We'll love you just the way you are if you're perfect.
These little saboteurs, they will tell us to do things and then they criticize us for what doing what they said. And that's what you said parents do. I had never thought of it that way. It's like the eating disorder, for instance, is the easiest example because it's like it will tell a bulimic to binge. And then it's the first one there to say, you've really fucked it up. And as an alcoholic, we know who told me to drink so goddamn much. And it's and who was sitting on the side of my bed when I woke up in the morning telling me how I screwed up the whole night. It's like I just realized for the first time that's an internalization of our parents.
I always appreciate, Tom, when you say that these inner saboteurs, you know, they're kind of like the least qualified, but they have no conception that it may be wrong. They're never wrong.
They speak with tremendous authority. What's amazing to me is those of us who have a history of such self-esteem issues, these guys inside our head, this is just part of it that is fascinating. These guys never have self-doubt. There are these little narcissists inside us, otherwise non-narcissistic people. And it's like, no matter how many times they're wrong, if we know somebody externally, if one of us is just, every time we speak, the other one's kind of roll their eyes and go, here he goes again. It's like, we kind of make an adjustment for that. We tune out Uncle Fred, you know? But the inner saboteurs, they can be wrong every damn time. And when they speak, we go, what? And we tune in completely. They have this authority. It's the old commercial of when E.F. Hutton speaks. We probably don't have many people old enough to remember that one. But
here's a book we all wish we'd written. The title is Often Wrong, Never in Doubt.
It's perfect. That's it.
That's the president's autobiography. Yeah. One part of emotional sobriety I trip on sometimes is in the acceptance and surrender, then what does the action become? Reverting back to serenity, it's accept what we must and then change what we can. It's a very kind of delicate dance. And I'm always trying to kind of find where do I need to be stepping in and really kind of like putting my back into something, or when does that become unhealthy? And I'm becoming just too attached to something, to a specter.
You frame this as when I get it wrong, what's the action to take? And maybe the judgment is what's wrong, and see yourself as just becoming. There, the end of the script isn't written. You're not an actor who lost your script, right? You know, you are becoming. Becoming is the antithesis of, you know, that sort of Oxford, you know, that Oxford stuff that has found its way into sort of 12-step lore, right? Like absolute purity, absolute honesty. Like the absolutes are, that's not the human experience.
I mean, man, talk about something to have to put your back into in an ironic way. Doing nothing is when nothing needs to be done is one of the more difficult things. I mean, I'm that's still cringe. I cringe at that. I read your thing when you sent it out. And this is one thing, it's a work in progress, but I was writing it yesterday. It's called A Meaningful Life. We learn to navigate the cluttered, often toxic waters of our lives. Our practice is to not be distracted to step around the distraction by the meaningless and to invest in what is meaningful. And this is the part you're talking about, Joe. We learn not to waste our time evaluating ourselves and others in present time. That's for later. We can't evaluate ourselves while we're going through this.
My sponsor used to say, if there is a God, he's not going to judge any one specific thing you've done, but look at your life as a whole. Whole process of unfolding. I was just looking up the definition of becoming, the process of coming to be something, process of coming to be something, or of a passing into a state. It's such a great image, isn't this, Tom? I love what you wrote. I mean, I think that's, you know, how to navigate around those things that are meaningless and find and to focus on those things that are meaningful. You know, I was just thinking of John Lennon's song for some reason, Imagine. Imagine a consciousness where there's no such thing as mistake. Imagine a consciousness that takes everything and processes it to grow and learn from it. An experience of freedom that would be, because now everything in life can continue to contribute to me becoming whole, because it's all part of an experience. There's no evaluation on it. You know, if we take away, imagine a world where there's no evaluation, where there's no right and wrong.
I believe that all of this stuff, that world you just described, peace, recovery, everything. I believe, rather than, you know, it's something we're moving to move, you know, the only time it is to move into a state, as you defined it, is a present tense experience, unless I'm like traveling to Arkansas. But it's the peace, the serenity, the non-judgment runs right down the center of me, is what I believe. And in my life, my job, here's where I used to live. Now I'm using hand gestures for an audio program, but it's like, I'm so brilliant. My way off the mark. It's like, and so nowadays, I think probably us, this is my center. It's like, I'm living this way. This is the imperfect nature, but there are times where I'm crossing that. I feel it, you know, we can have a conversation like this. And I think that's what happens to me. I think it happens to all of us when we're having a talk and when we hear somebody say something that just resonates with us. It's like, we go to that spot, you know, and that's why we get frustrated, I think, because we think, or for a long time, I used to think, well, okay, I got that concept, so I'll be good now. You know, well, no, it's like, I've just caught a glimpse of that, you know, and I'm going to try to stay closer and closer and closer to it. But and that's fine. And there's no judgment to that, because nobody's expecting me, and I shouldn't be expecting me to live lined up with it, because I'm a human.
You're talking about like the sort of from chaos to order, you know, somewhere you see the middle as you're passing by it. Yeah. And in my early sobriety, and I'm talking about my first 20 years, you know, I used to say my approach is, well, I have 1 foot in boiling water, 1 foot in a bucket of ice. On the average, I'm perfectly comfortable.
It do be like,
but
that
that's
sometimes
not true, right? Living in those opposite extremes. Right? You know,
okay. Well, you know, okay, my relationship.
I'm quite balanced, Joe says.
Yeah. I mean, there is a reality that I used to accept where I would be in a small room, a dungeon-like room, and I would just drink all day, or I'd smoke weed all day, or take pills all day. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of relaxing back and just letting the current take me. And so this is like, recovery has been kind of reorganizing all the parts so that like my resting pace is a lot more constructive and I feel like more in sync with, you know, the universe than yep. that was. But you could see why I would struggle with like, or I would have fear of like reverting to that state, or like I'll just give you an example. Like I was in a meeting like last week, and I heard a conversation kind of going on between, like, I don't know, what do you call it when there's another person in your fellowship who's your sponsor's sponsee? Like it's like a sibling in sponsordom.
Yeah.
And anyway, he had
your brothers are part of the lineage, right?
I love that. Yeah, my brother. And he was talking to somebody who just came in from Seattle, a newcomer, had like a handful of days of sobriety. And anyway, I intuited that this person would need a ride to a group. And so I volunteered to go pick him up from Echo Park and drive him to Beverly Hills and then drive him back or whatever. And like, anyway, we ended up having like a wonderful time, just long talk in the car and traffic. And then at the meeting, all these people came up to him and introduced themselves, and he got like, he got set up with a bunch of phone numbers, and then since then we've been in touch. But like, you know, if I had just kind of been more passive and I hadn't like volunteered to kind of hook up with this guy and, you know, do some meeting, then you know, we would have never had that experience. Or like, you know, I'm hoping this is somebody who I'll be in touch with for a while. I always hope that when I meet somebody new, you know, in these circles. But like old me would have never taken that action. You know, I would have been too shy, or I would have been, you know, oh, I got to get back and drink or whatever. So I guess it's all this stuff is paradox. I was, you know, reading Eckhart Tolle yesterday, and I was just like almost just pulling my hair out, because like it was so beautiful what I was reading, but so much of it was about the tilting in the opposite direction. You know, there's like the principle, and then there's the counter principle, and then therein lies the truth. And yeah, it doesn't come easily to me, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Oh, it's like the God that, you know, your sponsor was talking to you about, not a reductionist. Right. You have to think of a complete whole. Right. The sort of non-dualism of it. Right. You know,
I've been reading Piaget's work. I mean, he was really brilliant. I mean, an incredible psychologist, understanding the unfolding of cognitive development and consciousness. In fact, his book is called The Grasp of Consciousness. Isn't that a great title? The Grasp of Consciousness. And, you know, he really points out this, that the formula is always moving from a more simple state to a more complex state. That's what life is all about. You think about it as, the egg and the sperm coming together, right? Now they start to unfold from a very simple union to creating this being that's so complex, right? The human being. He says consciousness is unfolding the same way, is it starts out very, very simple. And then as we mature and as the brain grows and starts to make all these synaptic connections and starts to prune certain connections, I mean, it's a remarkable process. He says we keep going from a simple state to a more complex state. And that new complex state then becomes the simple state that you move to the next state to. Mm. Well, think about recovery. Is that what our recovery is like? It's the same thing. In the beginning, it's just about don't pick up the drink. All right. It's a very simple concept, right? Step number one is we need to abstain because of our, you know, because of our obsession, right? Because this is an illness for us. And then it gets more complex, right? Then now our recovery is, the next thing is, how do I, you know, I got clean and sober. How do I stay clean and sober? Yeah, then it is, how do I live clean and sober? And that's where emotional sobriety comes in. And it gets more and more complex. Now, here's an interesting thing. It's what you were saying, Tom, is when that simple state is, how do I want to say it, riddled with toxic beliefs and ideas, what happens to the next development in terms of the next more complex development of consciousness? It becomes obviously influenced and tainted and confounded by those ideas. And then that becomes the building block for the next one. So now we're building a foundation that's based on a lot of ideas that don't work. And that's where the dependency comes in. If life is supposed to be a certain way for me to be okay, and that's the message we get early on in life, that becomes a foundation to our consciousness,
right,
which becomes a serious problem later on. And that's, you know, I don't know if you heard this, Joe, but I was doing some reading of Ernie Larson's stage.
Nice.
And I love Ernie's work. And he mentioned a concept, and we've been talking about this on Thursday nights now, of taking the second first step. Isn't that a cool idea? And the second first step had to do with this, that the unmanageability of our life.
Yeah.
And from an emotional sobriety perspective, the second first step has to do with really owning our emotional dependence. And what we believe is that we need the environment to support us to be okay. Yeah. It's so interesting. And then now we're talking about, because we're going through the steps, looking at the 12 and 12, how every step, when you take it from this second point of view, now the emotional sobriety point of view, changes the whole meaning of each step.
Right.
It's a very interesting process that we're going through. And, you know, you came and you participated when you were talking about step three.
Here's an Ernie Larson quote from 1987. The fact that many people reach a dead end or plateau in their personal recovery, and if they do not understand what is occurring, they frequently feel that they are losing their recovery. Everything that used to be so meaningful no longer is, and their newfound excitement and health no longer feels terrific. That's the time for that sort of second first step, or what Bill Wilson calls the new frontier, right?
Yeah, and Bill described it really well when he called it an impossible way of life, right?
Yeah, I was just remembering near the end of my using, I was having a conversation with my dad, I'm just remembering now, and who oddly, I think, is the more emotionally, one of the more emotionally balanced people in the family. And I was just talking to him. I was struggling. I wasn't able to put a day of sobriety together. And I was talking to him just about how depressed I was about the state of the world. And just like, you know, it's just so messed up out there. Reality is so disappointing. And I just remember like the way, the kind of the gentle way he was attempting to handle me, but also kind of like cautiously pushing back with like, it's about that environmental support. It's just like, yeah, so the reality is disappointing and the state of the world is very dispiriting, you know, but then why must the response to that be just to annihilate yourself? You know, like why you're, what he was doing was he was calling out my dependency on, you know, the emotional dependency, not something beneath what my addiction problem, which is just a manifestation of it. Yeah. Still working on it.
It's a bizarre thing to say compared to what we used to, how we used to talk about it, but it's up to us. You know, the world is what it is. It's up to us whether we're disappointed or not. It's like, that's how we interpret the world. And it's like, it doesn't mean we've got to be unrealistic. It just means, you know, it's really more determined. I'm just, you know, no, I'm not gonna, you know, I spent too much of my life collapsed in disappointment. You know, I grew up in a family where that was taught to live there. And it's like, you know, and so therefore it may be, it still is connected to that first voice, Patrick, but it's like, so, cause nothing ever goes away. So the first voice is still there. So I wake up and say, oh fuck. But it's like, it's just the first guy that talks. It's like, it's you know, that's not how I define myself. You know, I include him. It's like, he speaks first, and then I'm asking somebody to come in and get what else you got, you know, which is, you know, oh, by the way, you don't control much. That's the second line. it can seem dispiriting, but it's like, no, that's good news, because that means what I'm going to do today is more streamlined. I'm going to focus only on the things that I have charge over. It's like, because I mean, God, I mean, one of the things I've learned, I've become more and more aware of the longer we work with emotional sobriety is with observing myself and observing other people. Just the percentage of, if we could put a percentage of time on it, that we spend actually seriously working at trying to make things happen over things which we have no control, zero. And we, I mean, they're brick walls we're beating our heads on, you know, and it's like lunch breaks over. I got to go back and hit my head on the brick wall some more. I like this. Yeah, it hurts.
I had a new idea that I didn't talk about because I'll save it for another show. Truth or truths and the seven blind men and the elephant. So
previews of coming attractions.
Yeah. If anyone's curious about D. Hawk, he wrote a book about something called chaotic organizations, which is a portmanteau. It's two words combined, chaos and order. And, you know, a lot of recovery communities, like 12 tradition-oriented ones, are chaotic organizations. There's that quote is great. There's plenty more.
Thanks for joining us, Joe, and stay tuned.